Just to introduce the guys, Kevin Gomez will be the first speaker. Kevin has worked in general insurance for the past 18 years and is currently the appointed actuary for a number of Australian insurers and reinsurers, with experience in loss reserving and pricing across a wide range of business lines. He has a particular interest in reinsurance and capital management issues, having worked on reinsurance strategy modelling for both insurers and reinsurers. He is currently a consultant working with Taylor Fry Consulting Actuaries. Your second speaker is Sharanjit Padam. Sharanjit has worked in the general insurance actuarial field for over 20 years, specialising in reinsurance. He initially worked with some Lloyd's syndicates and reinsurers in London, and he saw the sunlight and moved to Australia, a bit like myself, having come from the UK barely 2 months ago. And he now works for Taylor Fry as well. He acts as appointed actuary to a number of insurers and reinsurance across the market and is the editor for the Actuaries magazine. And finally, we have Thomas Cherian. He's worked in the financial services sector for over a decade with direct experience and exposure to insurance and reinsurance sectors. He has also spent a large part of his career in broader credit and equity research with Standard & Poor's and Merrill Lynch, covering a wide range of organisations. He is currently the senior leader for the commercial portfolio analytics team at Suncorp. Please welcome the team.
Thanks, Richard. Start by giving... a bit of an outline of our presentation. So what we'll be seeking to do here is to define alternative capital. We'll sort out what the main types of alternative capital solutions are. We'll showcase some recent transactions, alternative capital transactions. We'll then focus on an in-depth case study of one particularly large transaction and discuss a variety of triggers which can be used to define payments. We'll then have some nice charts showing a profile of the market, amounts issued, trigger type, by perils and cedents, and so on. And then we'll finish off with an analysis of the drivers and a bit of crystal ball gazing into what the future may hold, both globally and within Australia, in terms of the alternative capital solutions. So, firstly, by way of introduction... to our presentation, and I've called this introduction, but it should probably read disclaimers, because these are a series of disclaimers. First disclaimer: our presentation is mostly a collation of existing literature. Apologies to those who came along expecting something highly innovative and original. So I'm afraid we've kind of collated literature that's out there. Second disclaimer, we have limited first-hand experience of alternative capital solutions. In fact, none of the three authors have actually worked on a transaction before. So we aren't experts, but we are interested in this area. Undoubtedly, there are people in the audience here who will know more about the topic than us, and we're choosing to regard this as an opportunity rather than a threat. So if you do know something that could help add to the discussion, please don't be shy. We'd love to hear your views either during the talk or at the end. So why are we interested? Well, this is an area, the alternative capital, which has shown massive growth. It's been around for a while, but particularly of late, it has shown some growth. So it really begs the question, I mean, what are the implications of this? And both overseas and in Australia. We'll start with a nice simple diagram to define alternative reinsurance capital. And you'll be familiar, of course, with the interaction between an insurer and the consumer. So the consumer seeks to transfer risk to the insurer. The insurer, in turn, may seek to transfer risk and get capital support from a reinsurer, or they might get it from an alternative vehicle. So this alternative vehicle can take a variety of forms, and we'll cover that through the course of our presentation. From the investor perspective, An investor could either invest in a reinsurer, providing equity to a reinsurer, and in doing so will no doubt seek an appropriate rate of return on that investment. Or they could invest via an alternative vehicle, which is providing collateral support to the insurer. And quite often these alternative vehicles are packaged as debt-type investments, so they'll look like a debt investment to the investor, which really means that that affects the rate of return that the investor will seek from the alternative vehicle. The hurdle rate of return may be lower, and that might have implications for the pricing of the capital support that the alternative vehicle can provide. Now, in terms of the various types of alternative capital, what a survey of the literature shows is that really there aren't standard definitions in terms of alternative capital. And what you'll notice is that terms can often be used interchangeably. But here's a nice diagram, the diagram to the left, which shows, which attempts to categorise into some broad categories the alternative capital, the different types of alternative capital. And so it really says, okay, you can have alternative capital which operates differently from traditional reinsurance. So things like industry loss warranties, cat bonds, or collateralised reinsurance. You can have alternative capital which could be deployed and appear similar to traditional reinsurance, such as fronting arrangements or sidecars, reinsurance sidecars, or you've got the hedging instruments such as cat futures and derivatives. Really, our presentation is focused mainly on the alternative capital which operates differently from the traditional reinsurance. So I'll just really focus on those items in terms of definitions. So you'll see the term insurance-linked securities used, and it tends to be used like as a bit of an overarching term, so it covers a variety of different securitised type structures. Industry loss warranties are an example of an insurance-linked security, and that's security where the payment is dependent on an industry loss index. So it could be a defining industry losses at a particular level, but not necessarily insurer losses, which are more classed as indemnity type triggers. But often the industry loss warranties will also have a double trigger, so it could have an industry loss as well as an insurer indemnity loss. Cat bonds are another example of an ILS, insurance-linked security. So these are risk-linked securities which transfer a specific set of risks from the insurer, from the issuer to the investor. The investor receives an attractive coupon payment on their bond, but really risk losing their principal if a qualifying cat event does occur. So that's the payoff there. And then we have collateralised reinsurance, which is a reinsurance contract or program which is fully collateralised, typically by investors or third-party capital. Usually the collateral provided is for the full reinsurance contract limit less the net premiums. Okay, and the chart off to the right just gives you some basic statistics on the size of the market we're talking about. So if we look at the global exposed cat risk of around about $500 billion, about $200 billion of that is risk not transferred, so that might be retained by the direct insurer. About $200 billion of it is met by traditional forms of reinsurance. In terms of the alternative capital solutions, they'll look relatively small by comparison to traditional reinsurance. So cat bonds estimates are around about $4 billion. These are per annum figures. Industry loss warranties around about $5 billion. It's difficult to get exact estimates of the size of collateralised reinsurance because it doesn't. The records are not kept in the same way as in a centralised way as they are for the cat bonds. and for the industry lost warranties. But the estimate that you'll that you see floating around in terms of the total size of the alternative capital transactions is around about $50 billion per annum. In terms of recent global transactions, and these are mainly on the cat bond side, so there was around about 35 cat bonds. This was at the time preparing this paper, which was around September. So in the 9 months to September 2014, there was about 35 cat bonds issued. The issue sizes ranged from as small as $7.5 million US up to $1.5 billion in a single transaction. And I've listed here some of the larger deals that occurred during 2014. And just a few points I guess you can note just by looking at that table of the larger deals is there's a range of perils that are covered there. You can see some earthquake, you can see some windstorm, you can see some hurricane. These are the larger deals, and that's why it might look like there isn't that much diversity in terms of the perils covered. In fact, if you've looked at the full register of cat bond transactions in 2014, you see some see a lot of diversity, particularly at the smaller end of the cat bond. So they even includes things like longevity risk, and lottery winnings is another one that you see in there. So people using cat bonds to cover the risk of that. There's a range of regions. So you'll see, there's one in Japan, one Europe, the rest the US. So maybe not that much diversity of regions. And that's reflecting, I guess, these are the larger transactions. But the US does dominate the cat bond scene in any case. The cedents include both reinsurers and direct. There's no Australian deals noted there. You'll note, in fact, there were no Australian deals at all of any size at the time of preparing this paper into the 2014 calendar year. The last Australian deal, or the last deal that involved any Australian risk transfer, was in December 2013. It was a $250 million issue of a package of QBE risks, which included US earthquake, Australia cyclone, and Australia earthquake. So I'll just focus now on one particular one of those transactions and give you a bit of a case study of it. And I'm using this to illustrate some of the key characteristics of cat bonds. So the one I've chosen to focus on is the Everglades Re Limited 2014. There's kind of a reason I chose it, because it's the largest cat bond transaction ever, or to date. So just by way of background, so the cedent was Citizens Property Insurance, which is in Florida. Citizens Property Insurance secured a fully collateralized source of reinsurance protection against hurricanes on an annual aggregate basis. So the covered business is both personal and commercial residential policies from Florida Citizens Coastal Account. So just a few things I'll draw your attention to in terms of the characteristics of this particular transaction. So you'll see that there's a risk modelling or calculation agent here, which is AIR Worldwide. And really, there's a high degree of trust that is placed in the calculation agent for any cat bond. The use of the calculation agent means that investors don't need to be insurance or cat experts, and quite often they're not. So they rely on the calculation agent to quantify the risk, and you'll see the calculation, or the outcomes of the calculation at least, I'll show you that shortly in terms of the next slide for this particular transaction. So the size of this cat bond, enormous by cat bond standards, it's $1.5 billion. As I said earlier, it is the largest cat bond ever. The trigger type was indemnity. Indemnity is really where the payout is based on the losses of the insurer themselves, and so it's that's preferable from the insurer perspective may not be the ideal outcome from the investor perspective. But so that's got the minimal basis risk from the insurer, and we'll cover a little bit more on triggers types later in the presentation. The rating was an S&P B, and you'll normally see cat bonds rated well either at this level or sometimes a little bit worse. Just important thing to note here is this rating really is the rating from the investor point of view rather than from the insurer point of view. The insurer, of course, this is a fully collateralised arrangement, so there is no risk from the insurer point of view. They will get their money. But from the investor point of view, it's rated a B because there is a risk the bond will default to them. Of course, that's if the event occurs. So just a summary of some of the key pricing parameters on this particular transaction. So the initial attachment point is $5.2 billion and the cover gets exhausted at $7.7 billion. And here's where the calculation agent has done their work. So you'll see they've estimated the initial attachment probability as 2.89%, and there's a 1.72% chance that the cover will be exhausted, and the expected loss under the cover, and you could think of this as the risk premium under the contract. The risk premium is 2.3%. And the pricing spread, which is really the way that this is the coupon payment or part of the coupon payment that that is received by the bondholder. But it's the component that relates to the insurance risk. The pricing spread is 7.5%. So you can think of that as the insurance premium or the reinsurance premium. And so if you looked at the expected loss of 2.3 over the pricing spread of 7.5, it's saying it's been priced at this issue was priced at a loss ratio of around about 30%, which I think looks fairly competitive for a higher layer aggregate excess of loss cover. The 7.5% isn't the only component. It is only one component of the coupon rate, and the other component is the risk-free return, because the collateral is invested, it tends to be invested in risk-free securities, and so the investors get that risk-free return, plus they will get the 7.5% spread, but of course risking their principal in order to get that. One thing you won't see in terms of this cat bond, or really any cat bond, is a reinstatement cover available. And I guess this is a major shortfall in terms of cat bonds, is investors aren't going to put their collateral up twice. So if they lose their collateral through the event happening and the cover being exhausted, well, they've lost it, but they're certainly not going to put it up again within the same year. So unlike traditional reinsurance, where reinstatements are part of the landscape, you will see reinstatements just aren't there in terms of cat bonds. So I'll hand over to Sharanjit now to talk about trigger types.
Thanks, Kevin. I'll probably zip through the bit I'm going to do. It's got more pictures and less words, and hopefully a little quicker. So Kevin touched on types of trigger. So I'll just go through some of the four main types of trigger. We've got insurer-specific, which is indemnity. So like Kevin gave in that example, the specific losses to a portfolio. This is what we're familiar with traditional types of reinsurance. We've then got modelled losses, which is essentially where AIR Worldwide would say, if this kind of event happened, and given your particular exposure, this is what we estimate your losses to be. So the event happens, and that's it. You know, so AIR use their catastrophe models to work out, based on the company's exposure, what the losses are. So it's a sort of hybrid. You're not waiting to settle out all the losses and spend time fixing all that up. It's an immediate figure, which is what the market needs in order to do the payout. Then we've got the industry, so the industry loss warranties, which Kevin talked about. And lastly, we've got parametric triggers. For those who are familiar with some of the weather derivatives, this is a bit the same kind of idea. You know, the number of storms hitting the eastern coast of the US, or perhaps, the temperatures at certain areas, or the rainfall at certain weather stations. Now, the interesting thing to note is that as you go up this chain, there's an increasing basis risk. And basis risk refers to the difference between what the insurers actually incur as an insurance loss and what they get back from these instruments. So when you have an insurance-specific indemnity, there's no basis risk. And all the way up to the parametric end, there is a lot of basis risk because your portfolio may not perform in exactly the same way just because there was a certain amount of rainfall in New York. So insurers tend to prefer indemnity because they reduce their basis risk. But as you become a larger insurer with a larger portfolio and a larger exposure, the differences become smaller. So you can actually take on a bigger basis risk. You don't get so much of a basis risk when you have a parametric type of trigger. Investors tend to prefer parametric because there's less disclosures. You don't have to know all about the particular writings of the insurer. You don't have to be a reinsurer, in other words. You can just be an investor who has figures, right? And it's less complex. You don't need to know where the insurer is writing, what kind of business, does it include commercial, does it include this, does it include that. You ignore all that. You just look at how much rainfall fell in New York. So there is this issue with the market between this movement between basis risk and what investors want and what insurers want. So I'm just going to move on to the next one. So some lots of pretty graphs now. So this is showing the size of the market. We've already touched on this. You can see the larger larger bars there are the standard market, the traditional insurance market, coming up to $540 billion in 2013. You can see the reduction in capital in the market because of all the catastrophes we had in 2010 and 11. Underneath it, those small little lines there are the collateral market. So the collateral market is still a fraction of the total reinsurance capacity out there, but it's growing as well, perhaps not quite as in the same trends as the normal market. The latest estimate for 2014 is $60 billion, so maybe 2013 hit $50 billion. This year we might hit $60 billion. A lot of the growth has been in insurance-linked funds, which are the examples we're giving you on the right. They like to come up with strange sets of names that reflect where people are from, as usual. And you can see there's been a massive growth. And I remember, going to presentations on alternative capital back in 1996 and everyone talking about this being the next big thing, and it just never happened until perhaps a few years ago. So there you go. Market by trigger type, so how has the market been changing over time? On the left, you've got the current market, and you can see indemnity is more than 50% of the market. And then next to it, there's that large blue one, which is the industry loss index. And then the remainder tends to be index-based. If you look up the top, there's a parametric amount. There's some modeled loss in there. But substantially, at this point in time, in terms of the outstanding capital, it's indemnity or industry loss. Looking at the other graph, the thing to look at in that mess is the parametric is the purple stuff at the bottom. And you can see that that's been decreasing over time, if anything. Industry loss warranties, the blue bit in the middle, you can see perhaps that's been increasing in recent times. And at the top, we've got, indemnity is the blue one in the middle that's been increasing over time. And at the top, we've got industry, which seems to be taking up the balance. Market by risk or peril. So, again, you can see that the largest part here is U.S. named storms and hurricanes. So we're protecting from Katrina's, Andrews, and that sort of thing. And those next to that is the cover that comes from U.S. multi-peril. So often, as, for example, that QBE transaction, you'll be covering multiple perils happening. We can see a lot of European windstorm. We can see U.S. earthquake. We can see Caribbean. We can see the lottery winnings, as Kevin mentioned. We can see longevity risk in there, and also the opposite extreme mortality risk in there. So really, the structure of these deals are, you can just about do anything you want with them. They are extremely flexible, and people are trying to shift risk in different ways. One thing to note is that there's no Australian perils in there. There might be some in the international bucket, but there's no other Australian ones. So we're not too worried about never having done one of these deals, because it'll be hard to find an Australian up here who has. Lastly, market by cedent. Not only has the size of the market been growing, but also the number of participants. So, in the beginning there was Munich Re, Girling, and now you can see there's a much wider spread. The major cedents include some very well-known names such as Swiss Re, AIG, SCOR, Munich Re. So, there's lots said out there about this market displacing reinsurers and reinsurance capital. But the reality is that the participants are still reinsurers. The largest participants are still reinsurers. So it's actually reinsurers are seeing this as another way of selling their own business, I think, as opposed to being a competitor. Just underlying the point that there's no market in Australia at the moment, this is where most of the funds are based. You can see that they're mostly based in Bermuda or Switzerland, and those are the main countries. Great. So maybe I'll pass on to Thomas. Thank you.
Thanks, Sharanjit. So we sort of heard about the basics of the market and some of the trends in the last 10 to 15 years in terms of how quickly the market has grown. So the obvious question for the people in this room would be, what does it actually mean for Australia? Sorry, I don't have any pretty pictures because the message is pretty simple. it's rather than sort of having direct effect, it's the secondary effect of the capital being displaced in the international markets that we're feeling. And most people that work at an insurer, you'll see when the reinsurance treaty gets renewed, there's been pricing decreases, and part of that is effectively this additional capital that's been displaced coming into our market and driving prices lower. In terms of the spillover of this capital, and we saw it in the property cat sector, and that's where most of the capital's come off from. And a lot of the traditional capital now is looking for a new home in the local market, and some of that spilling into casualty as well. Interestingly, the lines between reinsurer, insurer, and broker has been blurred at the moment, and part of it is probably because of the surplus capital in the market. So reinsurers are setting up back-end sort of underwriting agency type operations. You've got brokers trying to get into the insurance space. So it's interesting sort of stage of the market at the moment, because lots of people are wary of lower prices and thinking, okay, capital needs to go somewhere else. And you'll see more and more innovative competition coming into the insurance marketplace as a result. There's also potential opportunities for Australian investors to invest in some of these, and I'm sure some of the large super funds indirectly probably has exposure to this market. The last bullet point there, and there I have seen a hypothesis that there's going to be a price increase, because now that the traditional capital is coming back into Australia and the weighting to the US market is decreasing, the whole sort of diversification argument that used to be quite prevalent in the old days, where people used to love our region because it's got extra diversification, might hold less weight. But I'll put it in brackets, because I'm a firm believer that it's a basic rules of supply and demand. If you're going to get more capital into a market, prices are going to go down. So, that's a good theoretical argument, but perhaps, I've got to wait and see if that actually happens. Moving on. So looking at it from an investor perspective, what are the drivers of supply? Why would you want to invest? And your average fund manager doesn't know anything about cat modeling, weather risk, reinsurance for that matter. And why would you want to go and put your money against something like this? And the biggest sort of factor I would say is, you know, getting better, more efficient risk return points on their portfolio. So traditionally you've had fund managers invest in your standard sort of asset classes, equity, bonds and cash and, you know, private equity, etc. But as we all know, through the GFC, a lot of these asset classes that were thought to be diversified were actually quite correlated. So hence, there's a sort of rethink on diversification. You know, are you really getting diversity in your portfolio? And then, you know, you have these alternate sort of classes come in. And it's hard to argue that, you know, financial market collapses caused natural catastrophes. So, you know, happy to debate that, or vice versa. So there's certainly a diversity argument, and that's where a lot of the fund managers see, and even the larger, you know, initially it was all the specialist reinsurance funds, but now you're seeing a lot of larger pension funds actually put money against some of these assets. There's also the yield enhancement, but it's probably more the risk-return profile. So, you know, you have a small segment of this in your portfolio. Effectively, you're getting a better sort of or more efficient portfolio. And people have sort of talked about that aspect as well. The chart on the bottom right sort of tracks the spreads on cat bonds. So it's a 2% cat bond. So 2% denotes the expected loss from the cat bond against junk bonds over the last 10 to 12 years. And this was published in the Institute magazine a couple of months back. But what's interesting is the spread increases aren't actually, you know, in post-Katrina or Rita or Wilma. You'd expect cat bond spreads to sort of spike, but, you know, it wasn't that. It was actually, you know, things like the GFC that actually caused the spikes in yields on the cat bond. So I think what that says to me is there is a diversification argument, but there's also a little bit of a market misunderstanding because they don't quite grasp, you know, when things go bad, anything that's rated B or double B gets hit with the same sort of thinking, you know, it's junk. We've got to get more return for our money type of thing. So, you know, maybe over time you'll see that diversification argument actually come through a bit better as the markets get more educated around the risk and the nature of these instruments. Just focusing on that spread story again, and this is, again, it's an evolving market, and it's still, I would say, quite early stages. Back in 2000, normally you look at spreads over your expected loss, and you can see there's a steep curve. Back in 2000, you're seeing around the 2% mark, something like 9% spread being required for someone to actually put money against a cat bond. And the other thing you would observe is, you know, there's only a, you know, few scattered bubbles around there, and it's mainly around the U.S. hurricanes, as a couple of guys touched on already. But fast forward to 2014, and you know, it's just heaps out there at the moment in terms of new issues, and the spread itself, the curve itself, has come down and flattened a bit more. So for the same 2% expected loss bond, back in 2000, it was around 9% spread. Now it's come down to about 4.5%. So effectively, that pricing differential has come down a lot. And, you know, now more than ever, it's actually a real viable option for a lot of the companies, just on the pricing story alone. We sort of touch on drivers of demand, why issue. And based on that pricing differential, you know, you can see it's getting cheaper for insurers to tap into some of these markets. I mean, the traditional reinsurers still have a relationship argument, and there's a lot of IP that goes from the reinsurer to the insurer. So perhaps that's not fulfilled when you go and issue a cat bond. But effectively, even in a traditional reinsurance sense, you know, part of the negotiation is trying to, I suppose, use this as another card to play to drive prices down. So, you know, you can see, I think Sid had it in his presentation earlier today, where this capital is coming in, and people over time, I've seen numbers like, you know, 30% off the reinsurance purchase might eventually end up in this sort of space using alternate instruments. obviously there's a big push to get it closer and closer to the insurer's loss. So the whole sort of basis argument is quite important, especially for insurers in our market. The closer and closer these instruments get to the traditional solution, and the more viable it will become in our market. There's obviously drawbacks of issuing some of this. You've got the time and the complexity. People are not as familiar with the structuring side of things. You've also got the additional overhead of trying to convince your regulator or rating agency that this is actually risk transfer, and you're going to get some actual benefit in terms of the capital side of things. So in Australia, I think the biggest obstacle is trying to get capital credit for some of these alternate solutions. APRA is quite conservative, and in some ways, we've been sort of safeguarded through the GFC because of some of the conservatism. So it's hard to argue that regulators shouldn't be conservative. Having said that, it does, I suppose, stifle some of this innovation in our local market. You need to have special dispensation from APRA if you want some of this on your program, especially if you want credit for it in your ICRC. And especially where it's parametric type cover, you'll be very unlikely to get approval from APRA. There's also other things that's not there, like collateralization. You can't have your money sitting with Bank of New York or someone like that. APRA is quite adamant that it needs to be within a financial institution regulated by them. Doesn't matter if local regulation, local bank is A+, and the international bank is AAA. They still prefer people locally. And I think traditional solutions in the local market have been quite effective, and the market's been competitive. So it hasn't really prompted that increased use in the alternative sense, like some of the windstorm perils and things like that in the US, where after certain storms, capacity gets pricey, and then this sort of market becomes more viable. So a little bit of a crystal ball gazing, we sort of sat together and tried to come up with ways we could use this outside the traditional sense, whether there's applications for national natural disaster resilience funding for Australia, cat pools and the cat, we've seen several governments like Mexico and Philippines issue into this market trying to tap into cat bonds to mitigate some of that risk. Whether similar solutions are possible for us. Even large sort of infrastructure exposures that might be too much for the local market to absorb, whether there's a possibility to tap these capital pools. Terrorism, again, we put it down there, but how do you model a terrorism event? It's not as straightforward as modeling a property cat. But again, one of those places where people might be less averse to putting money against it, given the low likelihood in our region. Even innovating around the SOI index, whether bonds linked to La Nina and El Nino sort of cycles, and whether we can actually use that to sort of selectively mitigate some of the weather risk. We have an affordability issue in certain parts of Australia, and we've already seen the UFIs come in, whether longer term you could even have applications in the cat bond sort of space to set up instruments to fund some of those uninsurable or less insurable risks. One thing we sort of touched on was the comparison with the RMBS market. So obviously, it was a big thing before the GFC where every bank and is were pretty active in the RMBS market, but the whole thing broke down because people assumed the model was going to be right, and there was a lot of reliance on the model, and there was probably less sort of skin in the game for some of these banks, and we saw the big collapse through the GFC with a lot of the systemic risks being built up, and that's going to be a key sort of testing ground for this space, because there's a lot of reliance on the actual technical modeling that happens to set your expected losses. But and most people that have actually looked at cap models a bit closer will realize that, you know, even the modeling itself, while it spits out a number, there's quite a lot of uncertainty around it. And you know, whether there's, you know, a few losses down the line and people actually start losing trust in the modeling, that's a key risk for this this sort of space. That's pretty much the end of the formal presentation, but I think we sort of break into question and answer now.
Thank you very much, guys. Please join me in giving giving the guys a round of applause. Thanks to Thomas, Kevin and Sharonjit for their talk. We are very short of time, but if there are any questions from the audience, please step up to the microphone, introduce yourself briefly, and far away.
John Duraven from Swiss Re. I think, I'm not sure whether it was Kevin or Sharonjit that was presenting on the four different types of trigger, but my question is that the second most preferable option from a reinsurer's perspective was described as the model losses. That is where they look at your portfolio and then say, well, look, if an event of this sort of size or shape happens, then you should lose this amount. But we've seen some examples in this part of the world in the last couple of years where the amount that insurers have actually lost as a result of events has been very different from the amount that might have been sort of modelled. I'm just wondering if you might have heard anything anecdotally about situations internationally where that's happened, and I'm just wondering what the reaction of the insurer might be when they find that the amount that they're recovering under the alternative reinsurance arrangement is different from the amount that they thought they were protecting.
John, I don't actually know of any examples of that, of differences, essentially the basis risk. I think it is fair to say, though, that one of the reasons that there might be a lot of these models, issues around the US market is perhaps the cap models for that area are maybe more understood. I hesitate to say better. I don't know if that's
true or not. And certainly cap models I've talked to still say there's a large amount of uncertainty in the US cap models. But I think that's one reason why we've seen a lot more there, because potentially the models might be better and potentially your model loss triggers are more accurate.
The only thing I'd add to that, John, is that it can cut both ways, of course. So I don't think the investors would be thrilled if the model loss showed up as massive and the insurers just gets a windfall out of it.
Thanks, guys. Any other burning questions? No? Then in the spirit of this conference, I'd just like to offer each of the guys some more fruit to go with the apples from earlier on. Kevin, Sharonjit and Thomas, thank you very much for your presentation today.